From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Vladimir Putin oversees the Sochi Winter Olympic Games opening ceremony, but several international leaders decide to give the Games a miss.
Neither US President Barack Obama, nor German Chancellor Angela Merkel, nor British Prime Minister David Cameron attended the event, and that is certainly viewed by many as a sign of their disagreement with some of Vladimir Putin's policies.
President Obama finally signs a five-year farm bill. We look at the role of dogs on the front line after reports show a service dog is being held by Taliban fighters in Afghanistan, and the UK Prime Minister's passionate plea to prevent an independent Scotland.
A question mark hangs over the future of our United Kingdom. If people vote yes in September, then Scotland will become an independent country.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. A drunk Ukrainian forced the grounding of a flight in Istanbul after he demanded the plane go on to Sochi. That was just one floor as the Winter Olympics got underway in Sochi, Russia, with a few issues at the opening ceremonies. From FSN's Moscow Bureau, Daria Bondarchuk reports.
The plane of the Turkish low-cost company Pegasus Airlines, en route from the city of Kharkov in Ukraine, was landed in Istanbul's Sabiha Airport. The Turkish special forces held the airplane in the safety zone until they seized the suspect hijacker and searched the plane for explosives. According to the statement of the Ukrainian security service, the man was, quote, in a state of severe alcoholic intoxication and tried to go into the cabin crew shouting, "Let's all go to Sochi." None of the 110 passengers on board were hurt. Ukrainian authorities are considering opening a criminal proceeding to hold the man responsible for his actions. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
Republican House Speaker John Boehner has all but killed any hope of getting an immigration reform bill passed this year, one of US President Barack Obama's top priorities. From FSN's Washington headquarters, Nina Maria Potts reports.
John Boehner was commenting publicly for the first time since releasing a list of Republican demands for immigration policy at a party retreat last week. His U-turn, though, has Washington insiders wondering if he's in fact caving in to conservative hardliners. And he made it clear the White House would be to blame if a deal fails.
The American people, including many of my members, don't trust that the reform that we're talking about will be implemented as it was intended to be.
John Boehner's aides say he remains committed to immigration reform, but his comments have sparked anger among immigration activists, while Democrats say they're not surprised. They've accused the House Republican Speaker of trying to blame the president for his own failure to get majority support from his party. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has condemned insulting comments about the EU made by a top US official as totally unacceptable. Jack Parrick in FSN's Brussels Bureau has more.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said that comments made by the US Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs are totally unacceptable. Victoria Nuland, who's the US's top representative to the EU, made disparaging remarks and used expletives about the European Union in a conversation with the US ambassador to Ukraine. The phone call was about negotiations between the US and the EU on what should be done about the continuing unrest in Ukraine. And this circumstance reveals how fundamentally the two sides disagree on what action should be taken. The European Commission and Ms. Nuland are both refusing to comment on the matter. Jack Parrick, Brussels.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Wall Street closed the week on a positive note, that despite the second straight month of disappointing job figures, raising worries about a slowing America economy. Nick Harper reports from FSN's New York Bureau.
113,000 new jobs in January is significantly down on the predictions of 180,000. December's extremely weak total of 74,000 was revised up, but only increased by 1,000. Unusually cold weather may be to blame, but disappointing data for a second consecutive month could point to slowing growth in the US economy. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate fell another 0.1%, down to 6.6%, its lowest level for 5 years. But the lower figure may not be good news, with the chance that more people are leaving the labour market through retirement or simply giving up on trying to find work. Nick Harper, New York.
And British Prime Minister David Cameron is urging Scotland to vote against independence amid growing criticism over the campaign to keep the UK together. FSN's UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
David Cameron's message to Scotland is now, we want you to stay, and that the whole UK would be deeply diminished if Scotland chose to leave. This in response to criticism that no campaigners have focused too much on the potential pitfalls to Scotland if it goes alone. Mr Cameron is invoking the summer of patriotism fostered by Team GB at the 2012 Olympics, delivering his speech at the Olympic Park in East London, saying the best thing about the Games wasn't the winning, it was the red, the white, the blue.
The presidential palace and other Bosnia government buildings in Sarajevo have been set on fire as prosecutors demonstrated over economic issues. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The 2014 Winter Olympic Games in the Russian city Sochi are officially underway. A record 88 competing nations filed out during an opening ceremony that saw the Russian leader attend an event viewed by many as Vladimir Putin's pet project. However, there were notable absences, with President Obama and Germany's Angela Merkel among those who chose not to attend. Earlier, I spoke to FSN Sochi correspondent Anya Ardaeva, who watched the event unfold.
The Winter Olympic Games in Sochi are now open. The ceremony wasn't completely flawless. There was a moment when one of the five massive snowflakes, which were supposed to turn into Olympic rings, malfunctioned. But that was perhaps the only thing. Aside from that, the ceremony was quite impressive and included an overview of Russian history from Peter the Great to the Soviet times. It included ballet dancers, sports stars and other celebrities, and ended with Vladislav Tretiak, the legendary hockey goaltender for the Soviet Union, lighting up the Olympic flame.
Perhaps Vladimir Putin didn't have as many international leaders attending this event as he might have originally expected.
The guests attending the ceremony kind of reflected Russia's current geopolitical stance in the world. While Sochi organizers have declined to provide the names of the leaders attending the ceremony, the IOC said that it was aware of 44 world leaders coming to the event. Among them were Chinese President Xi Jinping, who is making his first official visit abroad after the Chinese New Year began, as well as leaders of Belarus, several European countries, and former Soviet countries. Neither US President Barack Obama nor German Chancellor Angela Merkel, nor British Prime Minister David Cameron attended the event, and that is certainly viewed by many as a sign of their disagreement with some of Vladimir Putin's policies.
The build-up to the Games has seen an international focus on several contentious issues in Russia. Can you remind us of what some of those are?
Security has been a major concern on the run-up to the Games following two suicide bombings in the city of Volgograd late last year, which killed 34 people. A militant group from Dagestan claimed responsibility. Continuing violence and terrorist attacks in the North Caucasus, where Dagestan is located, that is certainly something that Russia has been dealing with in the past decade. Another issue, a law banning gay propaganda among minors, which was passed last year, has also sparked a wave of criticism and protests, both in Russia and abroad, with human rights activists accusing Russia of violating the rights of sexual minorities. And certainly all those issues have been receiving a lot of attention and served as a reason for many people who have decided not to attend the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi.
Our Sochi correspondent, Anya Ardaeva. This is FSN Reports. President Obama signed a five-year farm bill today that took more than 2 years to draft. Speaking to a crowd at Michigan State University, he praised the bill for making long-sought reforms to crop subsidy programs and boosting funding for organic agriculture and climate research.
For more than half a century, this country has helped Americans put food on the table when they hit a rough patch or when they're working hard but aren't making enough money to feed their kids. These folks, they're looking for a hand up, a bridge to help get them through some tough times. There are a lot of big producers who are doing really well, but there are even more small farms, family farms, where folks are just scratching out a living. Now, despite its name, the Farm Bill is not just about helping farmers. Secretary Vilsack calls it a jobs bill, an innovation bill, an infrastructure bill, a research bill, a conservation bill. It's like a Swiss Army knife.
But the vast bill is being attacked by groups on the left and right for deeply cutting nutrition programs that millions of impoverished families rely on and continuing to funnel billions of taxpayers' dollars to wealthy agribusiness. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein has the story.
The Farm Bill signed by President Obama today, the product of endless months of backroom negotiations between Democrats and Republicans, will cut nearly $9 billion from the food stamp program over the next 10 years. This comes on top of an $11 billion cut in November, and it's expected to reduce the food budgets of up to 850,000 families.
This is a program that impacts senior citizens, people with disabilities, and working men and women and their children. 92% of SNAP beneficiaries are in those four categories.
That's U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking to reporters earlier this week. He explained that the food stamp cuts come from a rule change that makes it so low-income people who used to qualify automatically because they also needed home heating assistance are no longer eligible. But he promised to try to help those same people keep receiving food stamps.
I don't want to say today that we will be able to cover most because I don't know precisely how many folks will lose their benefits completely. But what I can say is those who lose their benefits because they no longer qualify under the LIHEAP exception now may still be able to qualify under the normal way of applying for SNAP. And we want to make sure that those people don't fall through the cracks because they need help.
Some activists and lawmakers are even questioning if the food stamp rule changes, nicknamed Heat and Eat, were politically motivated. The organization Democracy for America calculated that 97% of the cuts would hit D.C. and 15 states that have something in common besides a cold climate. They voted for President Obama twice and have mostly Democratic representation in Congress. But the cuts to food stamps are just one of several reasons many groups called on the president this week to veto the bill, citing insufficient funding for conservation, too much promotion of controversial genetically modified crops, and what they call corporate welfare. Jim Goodman is the Secretary of Agriculture for the Green Party Shadow Cabinet, a group formed to promote policies and ideas not represented by Republicans or Democrats. He is also a fourth-generation farmer in Wisconsin who runs an organic dairy operation. Goodman took issue with the praise the president and members of Congress have lavished on reforms in the Farm Bill that ended direct government payments to farmers, saying that a boost in crop insurance represents another form of waste.
Direct payments were payments farmers got, whether or not they were even planting corn or soybeans, they would still get a payment based on historic planting. Which didn't really make much sense, and that's been eliminated. The switch now has gone to crop insurance, and the payments that farmers make to the insurance companies is subsidized by taxpayers. So the taxpayers will be subsidizing the insurance premiums that farmers pay to private insurance companies. And the thing that personally I experience with crop insurance, the program is designed for farmers, large farmers that grow many acres of commodity crops. They really don't do as much to help small farmers that actually grow food for people.
Goodman says these and other provisions in the Farm Bill send the message, get big or get out, while the insurance subsidies also encourage farmers to make choices that harm the environment.
Sadly, we see a lot of farming operations that are growing to the point of in numbers of livestock that are threatening water tables, see a lot of that in the Midwest, you know, irrigation practices that draw down the underground aquifers, sensitive lands being brought back into production that should be left in grasslands or forest.
Goodman and other environmental advocates saw one bright spot in an otherwise grim outcome. The new Farm Bill restores more than $1 billion of funding over the next 5 years for programs to help beginning farmers, local farmers' markets, and organic agriculture. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
A second month of disappointing U.S. job numbers is raising concerns about the state of the recovery. 113,000 jobs were added in January, much lower than analysts had expected. So is all this down to freezing temperatures or is there more to it? To talk about what this means for the economy overall, I spoke to FSN's Washington correspondent Daniel Renches and began by asking him why over 100,000 jobs was being branded disappointing.
Certainly not terrible, Kevin, because it's still job creation. It does just about keep up with population growth averages, but analysts here are expecting a much higher figure of about 180,000, which would be more in line with the encouraging figures we saw from August to November last year. And as you know, December's number was very low at 75,000. And I told you at the time, didn't I, that, and you reminded me of it this morning, Kevin, that we should look at three-month averages. And now we're looking at a two-month average that's not so good. And I guess it is a cause for some concern at this stage.
But just as in December, we had terrible weather again in many parts of the US in January. So shouldn't we again simply blame the weather and expect some sort of bounce back come February's numbers?
I think you're probably right to an extent, but you should also take into account, Kevin, that these are seasonally adjusted figures. So we should expect the weather to be somewhat taken into account. But as you say, it was something that was pretty dramatic, this whole polar vortex. And the kinds of disruptions have been pretty dramatic. So I think that you can take some additional slack out of the system as a result of what's happened in the weather.
So Daniel, again, the unemployment rate went down from 6.7% to 6.6%. What should we read into that?
Well, on the face of it, for the White House, it's good, but the drop can be attributed quite a lot to the fact that some people are no longer actively looking for work and therefore drop off the unemployment rate. And we had the expiration of emergency unemployment benefits from Congress on December the 28th, which means, you know, people just had no incentive or could no longer be counted.
So is the overall takeaway that the underlying US economy recovery is faltering?
Well, there are some encouraging numbers when you dig into them. For example, in manufacturing and construction, which are generally pretty well paying, you know, middle class jobs, those expanded quite encouraging. Manufacturing payrolls went up 21,000. Construction payrolls grew about 48,000. And the average hourly wage ticked up a few cents to $24.21. So you have an economy that in some ways is creating some more good paying jobs. The retail sector, which went gangbusters in 2013, has actually dropped in January. So those jobs are generally not as well paid. And so if you are creating lots of well paying jobs, that in the end trickles down to lots of other parts of the economy. But you still do have this problem in the US economy between those who have and those who haven't. The unemployment rate is still pretty high. And the Fed now has a problem because the unemployment rate overall has come down to 6.6%. They have this threshold of 6.5% where they would now consider looking at, increasing the interest rate. Well, I think now the Fed is going to have to say, as they were hinting last month, they just can't use this as a threshold. They have to think more carefully about how they're going to pitch this to the American public. And they now have to think carefully about whether they continue tapering. That is a big question for the next Fed meeting.
Washington correspondent Daniel Renches. This is FSN Reports. Sound from a video showing what's thought to be a British Army service dog called Colonel being held by Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. The footage shows the dog wearing what's thought to be a service equipment vest. A Taliban spokesman said the animal was taken during a recent battle involving a NATO unit east of the capital, Kabul. The NATO-led coalition in Afghanistan confirmed Friday that one of its military dogs went missing during a December mission. For a closer look at the role of dogs on the front line, FSN's Rebecca Hume spoke to Ronald Aiello, president of the US War Dogs Association.
I've only heard of one other instance in the last 10 years of the military losing a canine. And my understanding is they were able to retrieve that canine.
So it's certainly not something we're going to be hearing about too often, which is good news. Now, can you just give us some background to military dogs? I mean, what are they traditionally used for and why are they used?
Well, the military dogs go back to World War II, when the our government started a program called Dogs for Defense, and they utilized them as to find explosives, landmines. We used to call them booby traps. Today they call them IEDs, improvised explosives. They basically are used to find the enemy. It could be a sniper in a tree, or it could be an ambush. It could be a landmine. In Vietnam, we had punji pits that we had to be careful of. And since World War II, we're still utilizing them the same way.
Now, it sounds like they're exceptionally useful to the military. At present, do you know how many are currently used in the U.S. military?
There's approximately 3,200 to 3,300 dogs in the military. And I would say probably 600 of them are in the Middle East, the majority of those being in Afghanistan. Probably about 80% of that 600 is in Afghanistan. The rest will be in some surrounding countries for support.
Now, what kind of actual roles do they carry out in places like Afghanistan at the moment?
Well, they would lead the patrol. They would be out front of a patrol, whether it be just a squad of Army or Marines, or it could be a platoon or even a company. It depends on the size of the mission. And they would go out front, and their job would be to detect any danger, such as IEDs in the roadways, booby trap explosives in a doorway as they walk into a building. It could be set with explosives. So the dog would detect that.
I just want to concentrate on this dog, Colonel, for a moment. Now, I've seen some of the pictures of him. I mean, to me, he looks visibly confused, and obviously he's with people that he's not familiar with. Do you think the dog has any kind of understanding or idea of what situation he's in?
No, probably not, but he did look confused. He looked like maybe he was abused prior to that video. And the dog looked frightened. You notice that it didn't move much. It kept its head down. Its tail was down. And that usually means the dog is frightened.
Yes.
So I would say they possibly could have abused them prior to that video taping. The other thing that I'm wondering about, now the British have confirmed that they lost the dog back in December 2013. But they have not confirmed that dog that they lost in December is the same dog that's in that video. So we really don't know if in fact, that is a military dog.
Do you think there's going to be any attempts to try and get this dog back?
There's a possibility. Now, I had, and I don't have firsthand knowledge of this, but I had heard that there was a military dog that was lost or taken by the insurgents, and that they did know where the dog was, and they went in and rescued the dog.
Ronald Aiello, president of the US War Dogs Association. This is FSN Reports. British Prime Minister David Cameron has made a passionate plea to the people of Scotland not to tear apart the United Kingdom by voting for independence later this year.
Centuries of history hang in the balance. A question mark hangs over the future of our United Kingdom. If people vote yes in September, then Scotland will become an independent country. There will be no going back. And as I've made clear, this is a decision that is squarely and solely for those in Scotland to make. Now, I believe passionately that it is in their interests to stay in the United Kingdom.
He warned that the Union, which comprises England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, would be thrown into financial and political uncertainty if Scotland breaks away. To discuss Cameron's speech and the future for Scotland, I spoke to our London correspondent, Ollie Barrett.
Well, the polls have long suggested that, no, it's not a realistic prospect, that the Scots will vote to stay in the United Kingdom. But polls have been narrowing slightly in recent months, and David Cameron's really worried that there's a chance of Scotland sort of sleepwalking into independence. It's also incredibly difficult to predict the results of referenda. It's very hard to poll because these are things that don't happen very often. They're things that involve hugely high emotions and so on. So it's difficult to predict, and David Cameron is certainly a little bit nervous. There's also been some criticism of the No campaign, which David Cameron is in a sense at the head of, i.e. the side which believes the UK should stay together. There's been a lot of criticism of the way they have handled their pitch to the Scottish people so far.
And why are the Prime Minister's efforts so far coming in for criticism?
Well, the criticism really has been recently centering around the fact that it seems like the Prime Minister's efforts, the government's efforts so far, centre on the potential pitfalls for Scotland if it goes it alone. That there's been a lack of positivity about Scotland and about the United Kingdom. It's all been about the warnings that Scotland might not get to keep the pound, that Scotland might have to reapply for membership of the European Union. And there's this sort of growing feeling that if you just keep on telling the Scots they wouldn't be okay on their own, they might be more likely to give themselves a chance to try and prove you wrong. And so today's speech has really been about that. It's been David Cameron trying to increase the talk about patriotism, around positivity about the United Kingdom, about how the UK matters more in the world if it is kept together, about the success of Team GB at the London Olympics of 2012. And so that's why David Cameron has made this speech. That's why this speech centered around the idea of the positive things about the UK and around this idea of patriotism towards a United Kingdom that includes Scotland.
The Prime Minister, the UK Prime Minister, gave this speech in London. Why didn't this happen in Scotland, where he would be directly addressing the people who he's trying to appeal to?
Well, David Cameron's Conservative Party have long been really unpopular in Scotland. David Cameron himself is pretty unpopular too. That puts him in a difficult spot because he wants to campaign for Scotland to stay in the Union. But he also knows that too many appearances by him north of the border might be counterproductive. So he's really leaving other people to do some of the main campaigning and to head up this campaign, especially in Scotland. Figures like the former Chancellor Alistair Darling, for example, who is Scottish, but is not a member of the Conservative Party. David Cameron has this referendum coming up this year. He's also promised Britain a referendum on European Union membership if he wins the next election. So he is all too aware that while he wants to keep the UK together and keep the UK in a reformed EU, he could be, it's possible that he could be the Prime Minister who presides over the breakup of the UK and sees a smaller UK with no Scotland leave the European Union. So he's certainly nervous, he's certainly anxious about the possibilities here. But as I say, the polls at the moment do suggest that the UK will stay together. But it is getting closer, and as the referendum creeps closer in terms of time, certainly nerves are beginning to fray, and there is increased criticism around the No campaign that wants to keep the UK together.
FSN's Ollie Barrett in London. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, we'll catch up with our Sochi correspondent for the latest developments from the Winter Olympics in Russia. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.